Now, I had had it in the back of my mind for quite a while that the next time Pastor Bill asked me to fill in for him, I would use a song that I have really come to love this past year as the theme for my message. How unusual, huh? Using a song as the theme of my message is pretty standard fare for me, probably because I find God speaks to me in music just about every day of my life. He uses my love for music as a way to invade my consciousness with reassurance and love. I think probably I am not alone in this, as I know many of you feel the same way. This time, though, plans turned out differently. I remembered that for 2 years I have been trying to find a way to fit into a message my experiences when my brother and I went to Europe and, among other places, visited Auschwitz. As I thought about our trip, I remembered a quote attributed to Edmund Burke that says, "All evil needs to succeed is for a good man to do nothing." Now, when planning this, I thought, I'll go online and I'll find all this about Edmund Burke, and I'll find the occasion that he said this, or the context in which he said this, and it turned out to be not that easy. I did find out a lot about Edmund Burke. He was an Irishman. He was born in the 1700s. Among other things, he was a philosopher of some renown and served in the Irish House of Commons and was very opposed to the English going to war with the colonies over American independence. Now, you know you got to like that guy. No one seems to be able to find out, though, exactly when or where he said this. They still attribute the quote to him. They just can't prove it. Now, I found a quote about him that I think maybe explains their inability to find out when he said this. This is the quote. Burke had vast knowledge of political affairs, a glowing imagination, passionate sympathies, and an inexhaustible wealth of powerful and cultured expression. However, his delivery was awkward, and speeches which today captivate the reader only serve to empty the benches of the House of Commons. Some speeches were in excess of 8 hours. Unquote. Now, I like to think that maybe it was during one of these marathon 8-hour speeches that this quote was born, but I can't prove that. Now, I was not alive during World War II. The year I was born, we are called baby boomers. We're the first of the baby boomers. And when I went to high school, many of the events of World War II were kind of glossed over in our history books. I knew little of the Japanese Americans being put in internment camps. I knew little of the Holocaust. Had we not done the play Anne Frank when I was in 7th or 8th grade, I would have known even less. So this gives me an opportunity to share 2 experiences with you when my brother and I went to Europe. Part of that trip was we visited the birthplace of our father, and part of that trip was the visit to Auschwitz. Now, the first story is one of homecoming. My father died when I was 24, before I could, should, or would have asked him all the questions I wanted to know about the old country where he was born. At the time of his birth, it was called Austria. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He was born in a little village named Borsice, and my brother and I decided that we would visit this village and see if we could find his house where he was born, should it be still standing. I so wanted that sense of family and of his background. I hired an interpreter on the internet, a lady named Helena, who met us in Brno, which is the second largest city in the Czech Republic, which is what the area is known as now. And together we drove to the little village of Borsice. Now, the day before, she had called ahead and found that the mayor would not be in the day we were arriving, but his secretary would be. And that was good, because you see, when I'm talking small village here, the mayor and his secretary was it. There was nobody else. She turned out to be very, very helpful. We did have a copy of my father's birth certificate, and she then copied out of huge books the record of my father's birth in 1907 It gave us so many details we didn't know. We were so thrilled. And Helena, in looking at my father's birth certificate, said, "And oh good, you have the address." I said, "We do?" Now, over the years, I had probably looked at that birth certificate 1,000 times. And while I was able to surmise what some of the information was, among other things that my dad celebrated the wrong birthday his entire life, I never saw anything on there that looked like an address. But she showed me 285, a number after the name of the village. Well, again, we're talking small village here. No street names. 285, that was the address. We were then more than determined than ever to find this house. The mayor's secretary then proceeded to call a family where the oldest living occupant of the village lived, a little lady who was 94 and still sharp as a tack. She called on our behalf, and the lady and her family not only agreed to talk to us, they invited us to their home. Now, she lived with her daughter and son-in-law, their daughter and her son, 4 generations in one nice little house. Tradition there, the generations lived together. She was known as the little grandmother. It was their title of respect for her. Now, when we got there, she had her babushka on. She had her crisp white apron over her little house dress. She had her sensible shoes and her socks rolled down to her ankles. She was the very epitome of a little Eastern European lady. Helena translated for us, and we spoke for a long while, and they served us light Coke. Did I mention there's no such thing as an ice cube in the Czech Republic? Anyway, she did not know the Bubiks, my dad's family, but knew that her late husband had lived next door to them while he was growing up. And yes, the house still stood. Now, her son-in-law, who was a very quiet man, didn't say much of anything, smiled a lot, suddenly came in the room and brought me a gift. He brought me this vase. This vase that was made by locals in the village right there. And I can't tell you what that gift meant to me. Thrilled is too small a word to have something that was made right there where my father was born. The granddaughter offered to take us to see the house. We drove there, and as we took pictures, and pictures of the roses, which our interpreter kind of poo-pooed and said, "Well, you don't need to take pictures of the roses. Everybody in the Czech Republic grows roses. They love roses." What she didn't know was how my dad loved roses. And now I knew why. And I was still just more thrilled than ever. And then the lady who owned the house came out to tend her garden. Our interpreter and the granddaughter went and spoke with her. And she was gracious enough to allow us inside the house. Now, I had been very surprised when I saw the size of the house, because I had thought my grandfather was a farmer, and the house just kind of seemed too big. And so I asked the lady, as she was showing us the house, about the size. And she explained, get my props here. The house was kind of shaped like this. It was at a right angle with two wings, if you would have it. She explained, as we were in this wing and we looked up, we could see that the ceiling, about two-thirds of the way down, was much higher in exposed beams than this part here in the corner. She said that was because at the time my father and his family lived there, that part of that L was barn. There lived their livestock, the feed for the livestock, the crops that they harvested, and they said that was a pretty traditional thing in that place, because the livestock being almost part of the house, the barn being all attached, helped heat the place in the wintertime. And then As we went on this side, she said, look up again. And we looked up at this two-thirds of this L here, and you could tell where the ceiling had been raised. She said, that is because this two-thirds of this L was pigsty. They also lived with their pigs. Now, it's something I, being a city girl, can't imagine, but I guess it worked for them. But what it left was this one little section in the middle where my grandmother, her mother, my grandfather, and their 12 children lived before they immigrated to this country. Again, thrilled seems like such an inadequate word for what I received from this village, from this visit to Borsice, from what I received from the wonderful family who were so gracious, what I received from the lady living at number 285. The one thing that made me sad in the Czech Republic is the thing that they have lost. Being occupied by the communists from 1947 until the Velvet Revolution, they have lost God. There's a whole generation, almost two, that know nothing of God. They're not curious about God, and it's very sad. If I ever, ever had the inclination to be a missionary, this is where I would go to share the good news with them. Now, this was very fortunate that we did this the day before we went to Auschwitz, because what a difference. When my brother and I planned this trip and found that Auschwitz is not that far over the border into Poland, we both decided it was a place we wanted to visit. To say we were not prepared for the enormity of what we saw, we're not prepared for the horror of what remains there, we're not prepared for our reaction to such a place, would be the understatement of the year. As you enter under the infamous archway that has the lie of all lies from the SS, work will make you free, you do not find one redeeming characteristic of this giant horror. Auschwitz is actually two or three camps in one. Auschwitz I was supposedly a work camp. Auschwitz II was the death camp, and parts of it were known as Birkenau. It is vast. You see where the rail cars brought in all these people crammed into these rail cars. To see the entire camp, you must be bussed from one end to the other. That's how big it is, and gives you a little idea of the population there at the time. Now, I had thought of showing you pictures of this horrible place, but God in his wisdom took that decision out of my hands when my little sinus surgery that I had on Tuesday laid me up until Thursday, and I was unable to get anything to the tech team. And then on Friday, when I thought I had this much chance of maybe still being able to pull this off, the motor on my furnace decided to go out. You know, the furnace motor that runs your air conditioning, especially on days like Friday when it's 90 degrees outside. And you know what? My furnace was only 41 years old, but they don't make parts for it anymore. They didn't even make a replacement motor. So most of the day Friday, the dog and I tried to stay out of the way of the workmen, end up sitting outside writing a lot of this longhand most of the day, trying to stay cool and having the furnace replaced. They finished a little after 6, and I knew my last chance of having any pictures since the tech team was now gone. But you know, in retrospect, I think it's a good thing. To put horror pictures up in this holy place where the Holy Spirit is here with us to worship, I don't think would have been right. In Auschwitz, you see so many bad things. You see execution walls. You see vast barracks with their platforms of sleeping arrangements that your mind cannot even begin to comprehend how many people were crammed in there. You saw the drainage ditch down the middle of the barracks that was used as a latrine for men or women with no privacy ever, day, night, It didn't make any difference. You saw other huge barracks that were also held thousands of people that actually did have some outdoor facilities, 80 to be exact, 80 to serve thousands. And if you were slow, you were shot. There was a building with a torture pit. It was 1 meter square. Now, a meter is just less than a yard, so it's maybe this big square. It's set into the ground in this basement of this building, and into this 1 meter square pit, they would stand 4 men, squeezed in there. How, I never know, other than the fact that most of these people were skeletal. And there those men stood until they served their sentence for whatever small crime they had committed, or they died. Most all died. And then there are the rooms of the things that the SS and the Nazis chose to save. And I'm not sure why, other than as a to show us, to help us believe and comprehend what went on in that place. There were rooms full of luggage, rooms full of possessions, rooms full of human hair, rooms full of clothes made from human hair. And then a room full of artificial limbs. Now, as you look at this room full of artificial limbs, your mind is really now in overdrive trying to comprehend how many people it would take to go through there that they could fill a room with artificial limbs. It was just unimaginable. There were rooms of eyeglasses, rooms of false teeth, of gold teeth. There were displays of toys taken from children and baby clothes taken off of infants. And I have to tell you that I kind of raced by those last two displays because at that point I could not handle anymore. I just about lost it. The gas chambers in the ovens that the SS tried to destroy and hide when the liberating armies approached are partially rebuilt so they can explain to you exactly how the exterminations were carried out. And now you're at the end of the day, a day when you've taken in more horror than you ever dreamed possible. And God gave me a sign that He is good. Off in the distance, as we waited for our bus to take us back to the parking lot, there was a group of people, young adults, and I asked somebody who they were. They were very much isolated from everyone else. They were definitely roped off, and it was you didn't need to be told that you were not to disturb these people. It was explained that these were young Jewish people who came every Friday to sing and praise the Lord, to remember the dead, to break the Sabbath. Now, we were there on a Friday. We weren't supposed to be there on Friday. We were supposed to be there on Saturday. But due to a change in our itinerary, we ended up there on a Friday. And it was a good thing, because the camps are closed on Saturday in honor of the Jewish Sabbath. But as I watched these young people stand, the men with their prayer shawls and their yarmulkes, the women dressed simply with their arms around each other, standing in this circle, singing, I knew that the SS had failed at its most important goal, and that was taking away God from these children of Israel. They still believed. They still pray to their God. And that song they sang was not a dirge. It was a song of joy. It was a song of praise. I didn't understand the words. I don't know if they were singing in Polish or in Hebrew, But I could tell by the melody, I could tell by their demeanor, that they weren't there as a funeral. They were there as praise to their God. I can imagine the words to Psalm 96 being sung by these young people. They sang so sweetly. The story of Auschwitz and other concentration and death camps must be remembered, though, not only by the Jewish people, but by everyone. We must be, as children of God, a living testament to that quote from Edwin Burke. I do not know why the world was unable to believe what was going on in these places until the actual days when they were liberated. I do know that they must continue to stand as a reminder to us all. And I know that there are those out there who refute the Holocaust, who say that it never happened, who say that the numbers are wildly exaggerated. I believe that God will not let these short-sighted people, whatever their motives, make us forget the evil that happened at Auschwitz, at Birkenau, at Bergen-Belsen, at Buchenwald and Dachau, and all the others. I had thought here that I would read the names of all such camps, but then I would have had to take a page from Edmund Burke and do one of his marathon 8-hour speeches, because I found that of various sizes throughout Europe, there were 15,000 of these camps. Most were not the size of Auschwitz. They were all just as evil, all just as deadly. How could anyone deny that kind of evil? Now, many times you have heard Pastor Bill from this very chancel, or myself, or another lay speaker, or a visiting pastor say that we are the hands and feet of God and Jesus on this earth. We need every day to remember that. The Holocaust itself and all these camps serve to remind us what happens when we fail. God doesn't fail. We do. We fail to be the hands and feet and the voice of God on this earth. Remember the quote, "All evil needs to succeed is for a good man to do nothing"? I do not judge the people during World War II. I cannot judge what I cannot understand. I do not know why the world as a whole failed all those people. Estimates say probably 1.5 million people died at Auschwitz alone. I just feel in the very core of my being that we cannot turn a blind eye to such blatant evil in the present or in the future, or forget it in the past. There is much evil in the world today, and it takes many forms. In the Sudan, many, many people are dying simply because of their ethnicity. There are millions of people in the world today that are hungry, and I consider that an evil also. There are people that are homeless and disenfranchised and are purposely being kept ignorant or poor. There are so many people who do not have the basic necessities of life, even water, and I have the nerve to complain about no ice in the Czech Republic. You know the phrase, unnecessary evil? I don't know where that phrase comes from, but I don't believe it for a second, and I don't believe God does either. How can evil ever be necessary? What is necessary is love and compassion and a willingness to do something when evil rears its ugly, ugly head. God knows this. He gives us love and grace and strength and fortitude and compassion and all we will ever need to fight these evil, to fight these evils in our world on his behalf. Take the love and the grace from God and spread it however and wherever and whenever you can. Be the sower of unending love, amazing grace.